Cassette 2, Side 2.
Michel looked glum. Is it? There were 50 women in the first 100. Odds are more than one of them were abused by men in their lives. More like 10 or 15 if the statistics are to be believed. Sexually violated, struck, mistreated. That's just the way it was. It's hard to believe. Yes. Sachs recalled hitting Phyllis in the jaw, knocking her senseless with a single blow. There had been a certain satisfaction in that. He had needed to do that, though, or so it had felt at the time. Everyone has their reasons, Michel said, startling him. Or so they think. He tried to explain. Tried, in his usual Michel fashion, to make it something other than plain evil. At the base of human culture, he said as he looked down into the country of the caldera, is a neurotic response to people's earliest psychic wounds. Before birth and during infancy, people exist in a narcissistic oceanic bliss in which the individual is the universe. Then, sometime in late infancy, we come to the awareness that we're separate individuals, different from our mother and everyone else. This is a blow from which we never completely recover. There are several neurotic strategies used to try to deal with it. First, merging back into the mother. Then denying the mother and shifting our ego ideal to the father. This strategy often lasts forever, and the people of that culture worship their king and their father god and so on. Or the ego ideal might shift again to abstract ideas or to the brotherhood of men. There are names and full descriptions for all these complexes. The Dionysian, the Persian, the Apollonian, the Heraclean. They all exist, and they are all neurotic in that they all lead to misogyny, except for the Dionysian complex. This is one of your semantic rectangles? Sachs asked apprehensively. Yes. The Apollonian and the Heraclean complexes might describe Terran industrial societies. The Persian, its earlier cultures, with strong remnants, of course, right up to this day. And they are all three patriarchal. They all denied the maternal, which was connected in patriarchy with the body and with nature. The feminine was instinct, the body and nature, while the masculine was reason, mind, and law. And the law ruled. Sachs, fascinated by so much throwing together, said only, And on Mars? Well, on Mars it may be that the ego ideal is shifting back to the maternal. To the Dionysian again, or to some kind of post-edible reintegration with nature which we're still in the process of inventing. Some new complex that wouldn't be so subject to neurotic overinvestment. Sachs shook his head. It was amazing how floridly elaborated a pseudoscience could get. A compensation technique, perhaps. A desperate attempt to be more like physics. But what they didn't understand was that physics, while admittedly complicated, was always trying very hard to become simpler. Michel, however, was continuing to elaborate. Correlated to patriarchy was capitalism, he was saying. A hierarchical system in which most men had been exploited economically, also treated like animals, poisoned, betrayed, shoved around, shot. And even in the best of circumstances, under constant threat of being tossed aside, out of a job, poor, unable to provide for loved dependents, hungry, humiliated. Some trapped in this unfortunate system took out their rage at their plight on whomever they could, even if that turned out to be their loved ones, the people most likely to give them comfort. It was illogical and even stupid. Brutal and stupid, yes. Michel shrugged. He didn't like where this train of reasoning had led him. It sounded to Sachs like the implication was that many men's actions indicated that they were, alas, fairly stupid. And the limbic array got all twisted in some minds, Michel was going on, trying to veer away from that to make a decent explanation. Adrenaline and testosterone were always pushing for a fight-or-flight response, and in some dismal situations a satisfaction circuit got established in the get-hurt-hurt-back axis, and then the men involved were lost not only to fellow feeling but to rational self-interest. Sick, in fact. Sax felt a little sick himself. Michel had explained away male evil in several different ways in no more than a quarter of an hour, and still the men of Earth had a lot to answer for. Mars men were different. Although there had been torturers in Cassae Vallis, as well he knew, but they had been settlers from Earth. Sick. Yes, he felt sick. The young natives weren't like that, were they? A Mars man who hit a woman or molested a child would be ostracized, excoriated, perhaps beaten up. He would lose his home, he would be exiled to the asteroids and never allowed back, wouldn't he? Something to look into. Now he thought again of Anne, of how she was, her manner so obdurate, her focus on science, on rock. A kind of Apollonian response, perhaps. Concentration on the abstract, denial of the body and therefore of all its pain. Perhaps. What would help Anne now, do you think? Sax said. Michel shrugged again. I have wondered that for years. I think Mars has helped her. I think Simon helped her and Peter, but they have all been at some kind of distance. They don't change that fundamental no in her. But she loves all this, Sax said, waving at the caldera. She truly does. He thought over Michel's analysis. It's not just a no. There's a yes in there as well. A love of Mars. But if you love stones and not people, Michel said, it's somehow a little unbalanced or displaced. Anne is a great mind, you know. I know. And she has achieved a great deal. But she doesn't seem content with it. She doesn't like what's happening to her world. No, but is that what she truly dislikes? Or dislikes the most? I'm not so sure. It seems displaced to me again, both the love and the hate. Sax shook his head. Astounding, really, that Michel could consider psychology any kind of science at all. So much of it consisted of throwing together. Of thinking of the mind as a steam engine, the mechanical analogy most ready to hand during the birth of modern psychology. People had always done that when they thought about the mind. Clockwork for Descartes. Geological changes for the early Victorians. Computers or holography for the 20th century, AIs for the 21st, and for the Freudian traditionalists, steam engines. Application of heat, pressure buildup, pressure displacement, venting, all shifted into repression, sublimation, the return of the repressed. Sax thought it unlikely steam engines were an adequate model for the human mind. The mind was more like what? An ecology? A fell field? Or else a jungle populated by all manner of strange beasts? Or a universe filled with stars and quasars and black holes? Well, a bit grandiose, that. Really, it was more like a complex collection of synapses and axons, chemical energies surging hither and yon like weather in an atmosphere. That was better. Weather. Storm fronts of thought, high-pressure zones, low-pressure cells, hurricanes, the jet streams of biological desires always making their swift, powerful rounds, life in the wind. Well, throwing together. In fact, the mind was poorly understood. What are you thinking? Michel asked. Sometimes I worry, Sax admitted, about the theoretical basis of these diagnoses of yours. Oh, no, they are very well supported empirically, They are very precise, very accurate. Both precise and accurate. Well, what? They're the same, no? No. In estimates of a value, accuracy means how far away you are from the true value. Precision refers to the window size of the estimate. 100 ± 50 isn't very precise. But if your estimate is 100 ± 50 and the true value is 101, it's quite accurate, while still being not very precise. Often true values aren't really determinable, of course. Michel had a curious expression on his face. You're a very accurate person, Sax. It's just statistics, Sax said defensively. Every once in a while, language allows you to say things precisely. And accurately. Sometimes. They looked down into the country of the caldera. I want to help her, Sax said. Michel nodded. You said that. I said I didn't know how. For her, you are the terraforming. If you are to help her, then terraforming has to help her. Do you think you can find a way that terraforming helps her? Sax thought about it for a while. It could get her outdoors. Outdoors without helmets, eventually without even masks. You think she wants that? I think everyone wants that at some level. In the cerebellum. The animal, you know. It feels right. I don't know if Anne is very well attuned to her animal feelings. Sax considered it. Then the whole landscape darkened. They looked up. The sun was black. Stars shone in the sky around it. There was a faint glow around the black disk, perhaps the sun's corona. Then a sudden crescent of fire forced them to look away. That was the corona. What they had seen before had probably been the lit exosphere. The darkened landscape lightened again as the artificial eclipse came to an end, but the whole sun that returned was distinctly smaller than what had shone just moments before. The old bronze button of the Martian sun. It was like a friend come back for a visit. The world was dimmer, all the colors of the caldera one shade darker, as if invisible clouds obscured the sunlight. A very familiar sight, in fact. Mars's natural light shining on them again for the first time in 28 years. I hope Anne saw that, Sax said. He felt chilled, although he knew there hadn't been enough time for the air to have cooled, and he was suited up in any case. But there would be a chill. He thought grimly of the fell fields scattered all over the planet, up at the 4 or 5 kilometer elevation and lower in the mid and high latitudes. Up at the edge of the possible, whole ecosystems would now start dying. 20% drop in insolation. It was worse than any Terran ice age, more like the darkness after the great extinction events, the KT event, the Ordovician, the Devonian, or the worst one of all, the Permian event 250 million years ago, which killed up to 95% of all the species alive at the time. Punctuated equilibrium. And very few species survived the punctuations. The ones that did were tough, or just lucky. Michel said, I doubt it will satisfy her. This Sax fully believed. But for the moment he was distracted by thinking how best to compensate for the loss of the Saleta's light. It would be better not to have any biomes suffering great losses. If he had his way, those fell fields were just something Anne was going to have to get used to. It was LS-123, right in the middle of the northern summer-southern winter, near aphelion, which, along with higher elevation, caused the south's winter to be much colder than the north's. Temperatures regularly dipped to 230 K, not much warmer than the primal colds that had existed before their arrival. Now, with the Saleta and annular mirror gone, temperatures would drop further still. No doubt the southern highlands were headed for a record winter kill. On the other hand, a lot of snow had already fallen in the south, and Sax had gained a great respect for snow's ability to protect living things from cold and wind. The subnivian environment was quite stable. It could be that a drop in light and subsequently in surface temperature wouldn't do that much harm to snowed-over plants already shut down by their winter hardening. It was hard to say. He wanted to get into the field and see for himself. Of course, it would be months or perhaps years before any difference would be quantifiable, except in the weather itself, perhaps. And weather could be tracked merely by watching the meteorological data, which he was already doing, spending many hours in front of satellite pictures and weather maps, watching for signs. It made for a useful diversion when people came by to remonstrate with him for removing the mirrors, an event so common in the week following the event that it became tiresome. Unfortunately, weather on Mars was so variable that it was difficult to tell if the removal of the big mirrors was affecting it or not. A very sad admission of the state of their understanding of the atmosphere, in Sax's opinion, but there it was. Martian weather was a violent, semi-chaotic system. In some ways it resembled Earth's, not surprising, given that it was a matter of air and water moving around the surface of a spinning sphere. Coriolis forces were the same everywhere, and so here as on Earth, there were tropical easterlies, temperate westerlies, polar easterlies, jet stream anchor points, and so on. But that was almost all one could say for sure about Martian weather. Well, you could say that it was colder and drier in the south than in the north, that there were rain shadows downwind of high volcanoes or mountain chains, that it was warmer near the equator, colder at the poles. But this sort of obvious generalization was all that they could assert with confidence, except for some local patterns, although most of those were subject to lots of variation. More a matter of highly analyzed statistics than lived experience. And with only 52 M-years on record, with the atmosphere thickening radically all the while, with water being pumped onto the surface, etc., etc., it was actually fairly difficult to say what normal or average conditions might be. Meanwhile, Sax found it hard to concentrate there on East Pavonis. People kept interrupting him to complain about the mirrors, and the volatile political situation lurched along in storms as unpredictable as the weathers. Already it was clear that removing the mirrors hadn't placated all the Reds. There were sabotages of terraforming projects almost every day, and sometimes violent fights in defense of these projects. And reports from Earth, which Sax forced himself to watch for an hour a day, made it clear that some forces there were trying to keep things the way they had been before the flood, in sharp conflict with other groups trying to take advantage of the flood in the same way the Martian revolutionaries had, using it as a breakpoint in history and a springboard to some new order, some fresh start. But the metanationals were not going to give up easily, and on Earth they were entrenched, the order of the day. They were in command of vast resources, and no mere 7-meter rise in sea level was going to push them off stage. Sax switched off his screen after one such depressing hour and joined Michel for supper out in his rover. "There's no such thing as a fresh start," he said as he put water on to boil. "The Big Bang?" Michel suggested. "As I understand it, there are theories suggesting that the clumpiness of the early universe was caused by the earlier clumpiness of the previous universe, collapsing down into its big crunch. I would have thought that would crush all irregularities. Singularities are strange. Outside their event horizons, quantum effects allow some particles to appear. Then the cosmic inflation blasting those particles out apparently caused small clumps to start and become big ones." Sax frowned. He was sounding like the Da Vinci theory group. "But I was referring to the flood on Earth, which is not as complete an alteration of conditions as a singularity by any means. In fact, there must be people down there who don't think of it as a break at all." True. For some reason, Michel was laughing. We should go there and see, eh? As they finished eating their spaghetti, Sack said, I want to get out in the field. I want to see if there are any visible effects of the mirrors going away. You already saw one. That dimming of the light when we were out on the rim. Michel shuddered. Yes, but that only makes me more curious. Well, we'll hold down the fort for you. As if one had to physically occupy any given space in order to be there. The cerebellum never gives up, Sack said. Michel grinned. Which is why you want to go out and see it in person. Sack frowned. Before he left, he called Anne. Would you like to accompany me on a trip to South Tharsis to examine the upper boundary of the aerobiosphere together? She was startled. Her head was shaking back and forth as she thought it over. The cerebellum's answer, some 6 or 7 seconds ahead of her conscious verbal response, no. And then she cut the connection, looking somewhat frightened. Sack shrugged. He felt bad. He saw that one of his reasons for going into the field had to do with getting Anne out there, showing her the rocky first biomes of the fell fields himself, showing her how beautiful they were, talking to her. Something like that. His mental image of what he would say to her if he actually got her out there was fuzzy at best. Just show her. Make her see it. Well, one couldn't make people see things. He went to say goodbye to Michel. Michel's entire job was to make people see things. This was no doubt the cause of the frustration in him when he talked about Anne. She had been one of his patients for over a century now, and still she hadn't changed or even told him very much about herself. It made Sack smile a little to think of it, though clearly it was vexing for Michel, who obviously loved Anne, as he did all his old friends and patients, including Sack's. It was in the nature of a professional responsibility, as Michel saw it, to fall in love with all the objects of his scientific study. Every astronomer loves the stars. Well, who knew? Sax reached out and clasped Michel's upper arm, who smiled happily at this un-Sax-like behavior, this change in thinking. Love, yes. And how much more so when the object of study consisted of women known for years and years, studied with the intensity of pure science? Yes, that would be a feeling. A great intimacy, whether they cooperated in the study or not. In fact, they might even be more beguiling if they didn't cooperate, if they refused to answer any questions at all. After all, if Michel wanted questions answered, answered at great length even when they weren't asked, he always had Maya. Maya, the all-too-human, who led Michel on a hard steeplechase across the limbic array, including throwing things at him, if Spencer was to be believed. After that kind of symbolism, the silence of Anne might prove to be very endearing. Be careful, Michel said. The happy scientist, with one of his areas of study standing before him, loved like a brother. Sax took a solo rover and drove it down the steep, bare southern slope of Pavonis Mons, then across the saddle between Pavonis and Arcia Mons. He contoured around the great cone of Arcia Mons on its dry eastern side. After that, he drove down the southern flank of Arcia and of the Tharsis Bulge itself until he was on the broken highlands of Dedalia Planitia. This plain was the remnant of a giant ancient impact basin, now almost entirely erased by the uptilt of Tharsis, by lava from Arcia Mons, and by the ceaseless winds, until nothing was left of the impact basin except for a collection of aerologists' observations and deductions, faint radial arrays of ejecta scrapes and the like, visible on maps but not in the landscape. To the eye as one traveled over it, it looked like much of the rest of the Southern Highlands. Rugged, bumpy, pitted, cracked land. A wild rockscape. The old lava flows were visible as smooth, lobate curves of dark rock, like tidal swells fanning out and down. Wind streaks, both light and dark, marked the land, indicating dust of different weights and consistencies. There were light, long triangles on the southeast sides of craters and boulders, dark chevrons to the northwest of them, and dark splotches inside the many rimless craters. The next big dust storm would redesign all these patterns. Sax drove over the low stone waves with great pleasure, down, down, up, down, down, up, reading the sand paintings of the dust streaks like a wind chart. He was traveling not in a boulder car with its low dark room and its cockroach scurry from one hiding place to the next, but rather in a big boxy aerologist's camper with windows on all four sides of the third-story driver's compartment. It was a very great pleasure indeed to roll along up there in the thin bright daylight, down and up, down and up, down and up over the sand-streaked plain, the horizons very distant for Mars. There was no one to hide from, no one hunting for him. He was a free man on a free planet, and if he wanted to, he could drive his car right around the world, or anywhere he pleased. The full impact of this feeling took him about 2 days' drive to realize. Even then, he wasn't sure that he comprehended it. It was a sensation of lightness, a strange lightness that caused little smiles to stretch his mouth repeatedly for no obvious reason. He hadn't been consciously aware before of any sense of oppression or fear, but it seemed it had been there since 2061, perhaps, or the years right before it. 66 years of fear, ignored and forgotten, but always there. A kind of tension in the musculature, a small hidden dread at the core of things. 66 bottles of fear on the wall. 66 bottles of fear. Take one down, pass it around. 65 bottles of fear on the wall. Now, gone. He was free. His world was free. He was driving down the wind-etched, tilted plain, and earlier that day, snow had begun to appear in the cracks, gleaming aquatically in a way dust never did. And then lichen. He was driving down into the atmosphere. And no reason now why his life ought not to continue this way, puttering about freely every day in his own world lab, and everybody else just as free as that. It was quite a feeling. Oh, they could argue on Pavonis, and they most certainly would. Everywhere, in fact. A most extraordinarily contentious lot they were. What was the sociology that would explain that? Hard to say. And in any case, they had cooperated despite their bickering. It might have been only a temporary confluence of interests, but everything was temporary now. With so many traditions broken or vanished, it left what John used to call the necessity of creation. And creation was hard. Not everyone was as good at creation as they were at complaining. But they had certain capabilities now as a group, as a civilization. The accumulated body of scientific knowledge was growing vast indeed, and that knowledge was giving them an array of powers that could scarcely be comprehended, even in outline, by any single individual. But powers they were, understood or not. Godlike powers, as Michel called them, though it was not necessary to exaggerate them or confuse the issue, they were powers in the material world, real, but constrained by reality. Which nevertheless might allow, it looked to Sax as if these powers could, if rightly applied, them to make a decent human civilization after all. After all the many centuries of trying. And why not? Why not? why not pitch the whole enterprise at the highest level possible? They could provide for everyone in an equitable way. They could cure disease. They could delay senescence until they lived for 1,000 years. They could understand the universe from the Planck distance to the cosmic distance, from the Big Bang to the eschaton. All this was possible. It was technically achievable. And as for those who felt that humanity needed the spur of suffering to make it great, well, they could go out and find anew the tragedies that Sachs was sure would never go away. Things like lost love, betrayal by friends, death, bad results in the lab. Meanwhile, the rest of them could continue the work of making a decent civilization. They could do it. It was amazing, really. They had reached that moment in history when one could say it was possible. Very hard to believe, actually. It made Sachs suspicious. In physics, one became immediately dubious when a situation appeared to be somehow extraordinary or unique. The odds were against that. It suggested that it was an artifact of perspective. One had to assume that things were more or less constant and that one lived in average times, the so-called principle of mediocrity. Never a particularly attractive principle, Sachs had thought. Perhaps it only meant that justice had always been achievable. In any case, there it was, an extraordinary moment right there outside his four windows, burnished under the light touch of the natural sun. Mars and its humans, free and powerful. It was too much to grasp. It kept slipping out of his mind, then reoccurring to him, and surprised by joy, he would exclaim, "Ha ha! The taste of tomato soup and bread. Ha! The dusky purple of the twilight sky. Ha! The spectacle of the dashboard instrumentation glowing faintly, reflected in the black windows. Ha ha ha! My, oh my!" He could drive anywhere he wanted to. No one told them what to do. He said that aloud to his darkened AI screen. "No one tells us what to do." It was almost frightening, vertiginous. "Ka," the Yonsei would say. Ka, supposedly the little red people's name for Mars, from the Japanese ka, meaning fire. The same word existed in several other early languages as well, including Proto-Indo-European, or so the linguists said. Carefully, he got in the big bed at the back of the compartment, in the hum of the rover's heating and electrical system, and he lay humming to himself under the thick coverlet that caught up his body's heat so fast, and put his head on the pillow and looked out at the stars. The next morning, a high-pressure system came in from the northwest, and the temperature rose to 262K. He had driven down to 5 kilometers above the datum, and the exterior air pressure was 230 millibars. Not quite enough to breathe freely, so he pulled on one of the heated surface suits, then slipped a small air tank over his shoulders and put its mask over his nose and mouth, and a pair of goggles over his eyes. Even so, when he climbed out of the outer locked door and down the steps to the sand, the intense cold caused him to sniffle and tear up, to the point of impeding his vision. The whistle of the wind was loud, though his ears were inside the hood of his suit. The suit's heater was up to the task, however, and with the rest of him warm, his face slowly got used to it. He tightened the hood's drawstring and walked over the land. He stepped from flat stone to flat stone. Here they were everywhere. He crouched often to inspect cracks, finding lichen and widely scattered specimens of other life, mosses, little tufts of sedge, grass. It was very windy. Exceptionally hard gusts slapped him 4 or 5 times a minute, with a steady gale between. This was a windy place much of the time, no doubt, with the atmosphere sliding south around the bulk of Tharsis in massed quantities. High-pressure cells would dump a lot of their moisture at the start of this rise on the western side. Indeed, at this moment, the horizon to the west was obscured by a flat sea of cloud merging with the land in the far distance, out there 2 or 3 kilometers lower in elevation, and perhaps 60 kilometers away. Underfoot, there were only bits of snow filling some of the shaded crack systems and hollows. These snowbanks were so hard that he could jump up and down on them without leaving a mark. Wind slab, partially melted and then refrozen. One scalloped slab cracked under his boots, and he found it was several centimeters thick. Under that it was powder or granules. His fingers were cold, despite his heated gloves. He stood again and wandered, mapless, over the rock. Some of the deeper hollows contained ice pools. Around midday, he descended into one of these and ate his lunch by the ice pool, lifting the air mask to take bites out of a grain and honey bar. Elevation, 4.5 kilometers above the datum. Air pressure, 267 millibars. A high-pressure system, indeed. The sun was low in the northern sky, a bright dot surrounded by pewter. The ice of the pool was clear in places, like little windows giving him a view of the black bottom. Elsewhere it was bubbled or cracked, or white with rime. The bank he sat on was a curve of gravel with patches of brown soil and black dead vegetation lying on it in a miniature berm, the high water mark of the pond, apparently, a soil shore above the gravel one. The whole beach was no more than 4 meters long, 1 wide. The fine gravel was an umber color, piebald umber, or... he would have to consult a color chart, but not now. The soil berm was dotted by pale green rosettes of tiny grass blades. Longer blades stood in clumps here and there. Most of the taller blades were dead and light gray. Right next to the pond were patches of dark green, succulent leaves, dark red at their edges. Where the green shaded into red was a color he couldn't name, a dark, lustrous brown stuffed somehow with both its constituent colors. He would have to call up a color chart soon, it seemed. Lately, when looking around outdoors, he found that a color chart came in handy about once a minute. Waxy, almost white flowers were tucked under some of these bicolored leaves. Farther on lay some tangles, red-stalked, green-needled, like beached seaweed in miniature. Again, that intermixture of red and green, right there in nature, staring at him. A distant, wind-washed hum, perhaps the harping rocks, perhaps the buzz of insects, black midges, bees. In this air, they would only have to sustain about 30 millibars of CO2, because there was so little partial pressure driving it into them, and at some point, internal saturation was enough to hold any more out. For mammals, that might not work so well, but they might be able to sustain 20 millibars, and with plant life flourishing all over the planet's lower elevations, CO2 levels might drop to 20 millibars fairly soon, and then they could dispense with the air tanks and the face masks, set loose animals on Mars. In the faint hum of the air, he seemed to hear their voices, imminent or emergent, coming in the next great surge of viriditas. The hum of distant voices, the wind, the peace of this little pool on its rocky moor, the near-gaulish pleasure he took in the sharp cold. "Anne should see this," he murmured. Then again, with the space mirrors gone, presumably everything he saw here was doomed. This was the upper limit of the biosphere, and surely with the loss of light and heat, the upper limit would drop, at least temporarily, perhaps for good. He didn't like that, and it seemed possible there might be ways to compensate for the lost light. After all, the terraforming had been doing quite well before the mirror's arrival. They hadn't been necessary, and it was good not to depend on something so fragile, and better to be rid of it now rather than later, when large animal populations might have died in the setback along with the plants. Even so, it was a shame. but the dead plant matter would only be more fertilizer in the end, and without the same kind of suffering as animals. At least so he assumed. Who knew how plants felt? When you looked closely at them, glowing in all their detailed articulation like complex crystals, they were as mysterious as any other life. And now their presence here made the entire plain, everything he could see, into one great fell field spreading in a slow tapestry over the rock, breaking down the weathered minerals, melding with them to make the first soils. A very slow process. There was a vast complexity in every pinch of soil, and the look of this fell field was the loveliest thing he had ever seen.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 2 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 3.